And as we were mentioning, all these closures and changes due to the COVID status changing, we this morning are going to check in with Abner Hoag, who is one of the incident commanders with the Emergency Operations Center, to get more details about what is happening. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Maria.
Thank you for joining me. And first off, just explain sort of what situation we're in and how we got there.
Wow, that's kind of a big question to start the day with. But
well, I guess first
I'll
off,
give it my best shot for you.
I was going to say we're at risk level four. So what
risk level four?
What happened to bring it to that level?
Sure. I'll give you a quick overview. I think most of the community has probably been watching what's happening and has seen a steady increase in new positive COVID cases in our community for the past week and a half, roughly now. We had double digit days most of last week. It appeared as we were going into the weekend, or as we went through the weekend, that maybe things had started to level off a little bit. In fact, yesterday morning, we thought we might continue to hold at level three. As we went into yesterday afternoon, we had another surge of positive cases come out of the different laboratories here in Ketchikan. Ultimately, we reported 15 new positives yesterday. And that brings us to 64 positives in the last 7 days. And that's just, it's a really big number, and it's across the various sectors of our community. I don't think there's been an age group or sector that probably hasn't been impacted in this outbreak. And we're up to the highest number of cases we've had in that same period throughout the pandemic. Our last outbreak back in October timeframe was really our biggest one prior to this. And we've exceeded the number of cases, the number of community spread cases. All of that has been exceeded in this current outbreak, along with multiple clusters within the community that are causing this outbreak.
You mentioned age across all age groups. So are there young people who are testing positive?
Yes, there's absolutely young people that are testing positive.
Okay. And then also you speak about the clusters. I understand that there are three.
That's kind of a fluid situation. It does change from day to day. A cluster, by the definition that's used in public health and epidemiology, is three or more cases related to an event or gathering typically. So that's a pretty low threshold to reach. Generally, when we're concerned about clusters, there's many more than three, and we have at least three. It could have increased with the new cases, but we have at least three in our community, and there's been several others recently that have contributed significantly to this outbreak.
Okay, and my understanding is at least the initial ones was K-High Hospitality Industry and a daycare?
The common one that most everybody had heard about is related to K-High and specifically the wrestling tournament. I think it's important for people to realize that cluster by itself was not really the start of this. There were pre-existing clusters prior to that that bled over to that and resulted in that cluster. People in the community, I think, have gotten some COVID fatigue, and that's resulted in more of these gatherings and more people just kind of not taking the same precautions that they were taking a year ago. There's a lot of belief that this isn't as dangerous as it is, that young kids are just going to be okay, that this is no worse than the flu. Those sorts of beliefs, I think, are becoming more prevalent. And I would say none of those are probably true. This is worse than the flu. A lot more people get it than get the flu. So even if the mortality rate is as low or lower than the flu, when you have a larger population impacted to begin with, the mortality, the numbers are going to be greater. Kids do get sick from this. And the other thing we don't know for kids is we don't know what the long-term effects of COVID are going to be down the road for them. If you look back in history at things like polio, when polio was active, we didn't know what the long-term effects were going to be, but there's significant long-term effects that occurred from polio or from the measles and other viruses that are out there that we just don't know yet because COVID is still new.
Something I've heard from people is that they want to know the sources. And I know there are privacy rules. And so you can't name names, so to speak. People just have to come forward on their own if they wish to. And also, I've had people ask about, you know, businesses. And again, can you explain why that information really can't be given to people?
There are privacy rules that cover what information can be released, specifically for covered entities. So like a healthcare provider can't tell you, Maria, that Abner has COVID, unless it's in the interest of public health and they can't get you that information otherwise. The same kind of applies to different locations. A lot of times, and we've seen it, especially in social media, people will start finger pointing at whoever this positive case is. And we don't want that to happen, right? We want the community to know what's happening, and we want them to be able to take appropriate action. But our goal is not to target any entity, and we don't want the public to do that either. So oftentimes, we won't mention a location as long as public health is able to adequately contact trace and identify people who may have been in that location. And sometimes that's done in partnership with the business or entity involved. If something happened at KRBD, they might reach out to you and ask for your help in notifying the people who were in your building. And so they do the same thing with other businesses and organizations. And as long as that's effective, then we typically won't announce where an outbreak happened specifically, unless they self-identify, and then we may refer to it.
Okay, and some do that and make people aware. I imagine right now, especially with a large number of cases, that contact tracing is difficult because you only have so many people that can help contact trace, correct?
Well, there that is true. There is a limited number statewide. There's a smaller limited number here in Ketchikan at our public health nursing office. Their staff is much bigger, I think, than I even realized until the pandemic hit and working with all of them. But we do have, you know, I think they have somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 folks working at Ketchikan Public Health, nurses that are, those people have been crazy busy. When you're getting 10 and 15 cases a day, they're trying to contact all those people within 24 to 48 hours and then identify their close contacts. So we have 64 cases in the last 7 days. If each one of those people had contact with 10 others, you're talking 640 people that need to be contacted and told that they need to quarantine, that they've been potentially exposed. They have to answer questions typically for each and every one of them. Everybody wants to know, how long do I have to stay in quarantine? What should I do? What should I watch for? All of those sorts of things. And so they're calling and contacting all of those people. And when you get into a case in the school, that gets often even bigger. Just a classroom, for example, is usually 20 students, I think. At least from when I had kids, it seems like that was the class sizes. So very quickly, those can escalate to a lot more contacts. School nurses, the district nurses are also work with public health, for example, in the school, and they will help to identify all those close contacts in the school setting and notify them as well. So we've got a lot of good partners in the community that are helping to keep up on this contact tracing and notification.
And what is the recommendation for testing? If you have symptoms, I would think, but what if you're not symptomatic? I mean, what are you hoping testing wise?
Is your question related to community wise or when you've been exposed?
I think community wide. Okay. If you're exposed, so, I get, maybe talk about that first. If you're exposed,
I'll talk about both.
Talk about both.
That's
great,
fine.
Great.
Yeah. So let's talk about if you're a close contact first. Your friend calls you, says, "Hey, I've tested positive with COVID and I was at your house for dinner last night," right? They tell me that was part of my infectious period. Let's just use you and I. Let's say I had dinner at Maria's house last night and today I test positive and they say, "Abner, notify your close contacts just so we can get this word out quickly." That's how they will start. They'll ask me to notify my close contacts first until they have a chance to follow up and do those contacts. So I tell you, Maria, you were exposed last night. The first thing you should do is self-quarantine. Away from everyone else. You shouldn't go to work. You should self-quarantine at home. The recommendation for testing following exposure is to test on day 7 or 8, I believe it is, following exposure. And then if you have a negative test, then on day 9, I think it is, it's 9 or 10, you can return to normal activities. I probably should have looked up those numbers, but it's right in there. And the reason is because about 90% of people who are going to develop COVID after an exposure will do that around day 8. And so you don't want to test on today if I exposed you last night, because you're not going to have enough viral load built up in your system to test positive yet. So that's the reason for waiting to test.
Okay. And then the other question of just someone in the general community who doesn't know if they've been exposed or not, is it something that you just wait until you have symptoms and get tested? Or
sure. So testing in our community is available pretty much for anyone who wants it at this point. We do the Birth3 drive-up testing. That is free, and it's for a lot of different reasons. We do specifically recommend that people who've traveled recently get tested after travel. We know that the activities that just have to take place in order to travel, you have closer exposure to other people, and you may travel to areas that are higher risk. So we definitely recommend testing post-travel. We recommend testing if you've been a close contact of someone, but we also recommend testing if you just think that there's a possibility that you may have come in contact with someone that has COVID. You go to, I don't know, I'm going to use... we'll say a concert. We don't have concerts here, but let's say you went to a concert. There was lots of people. You paid your money for it. You get there and maybe they didn't socially distance people the way that you would have liked, or for whatever reason, there was a large group of people and you just want to have that safety level. You can get tested in Ketchikan. But definitely if you become symptomatic, we want you to get tested. We want you to stay home and get tested. If you have even minor symptoms, and that's the challenge with this one, the incubation period is so long from exposure. It can be 2 to 14 days before you develop those symptoms and are contagious. But two, a lot of people who are symptomatic are having really mild symptoms. Initially, they might start with a little headache. It might start with a cough that you think is just part of your seasonal allergies. And unfortunately, people at this point are starting to decide to ignore those minor symptoms. And then they're out doing things that they wouldn't otherwise do had they become really sick. And so we really need people to pay attention to those very minor symptoms. Go ahead and get tested. Take a day or two and make sure that that goes away and doesn't develop into something more, and then return to your activities.
And it sounds now as though now the tests are being processed fairly quickly.
That ebbs and flows. Obviously, there's only so much capacity in a given provider, but we do get tests processed really very quickly here in Ketchikan. In most cases, our drive-up results are about 48 hours, 24 to 48 hours. In certain cases, they will prioritize tests based on the symptoms of the person and that sort of thing. If they're referred by like a school nurse or something, they might prioritize the test high consequence areas. But generally speaking, all of the tests from any given day are typically done in about 48 hours. We do occasionally, however, they have, you know, either a backup because of a surge in testing, or because of occasional supply from the manufacturer might create an issue. And we have seen out to 3 and occasionally even 4 days, but that's not very frequent.
Okay. Now the community is at risk level 4, high
risk. Level 4.
High risk, very high risk. So
very high.
What are the recommendations out now?
Well, a couple things I want to talk about there, Maria. One is... for fully vaccinated individuals, we know the risk is extremely low, that they'll become positive and that they really need to modify those activities. So for fully vaccinated individuals, we do have a set of recommendations, and those don't change between risk levels. If you're fully vaccinated, our recommendations stay the same. There's many different recommendations there, but I was just going to pull that up real quick and give you the very basics. Fully vaccinated folks can continue do activities with other fully vaccinated people without wearing masks or physical distancing. They can still visit unvaccinated people in a single household who are low risk of severe COVID-19 disease. They don't need to test before or after travel, or even if they're a close contact to someone, unless they become symptomatic. And they also don't need to quarantine following an exposure. So there's quite a few things that we recommend that, that they can continue to do. For unvaccinated individuals and those at really high risk of a negative outcome from COVID-19, we do have some more recommendations. And that would be that they avoid large group gatherings, especially those with multiple households involved. Stay home except for essential needs outside of the home. And then when they do go out, to wear a face covering that covers their nose and mouth, wash their hands, maintain physical distancing. Those things we've talked about for over a year now that, that are good protective actions are still good protective actions right now.
When you speak of fully vaccinated, that would be someone, if you either have the one Johnson & Johnson dose or the two of the Moderna or the Pfizer, but then also that two past that 2 week period, correct?
Yes, two weeks past the final dose of whatever vaccine series you get. So if it's the one dose, it's 2 weeks after that. If it's one of the two dose versions, then it's 2 weeks after your second dose, you're considered fully vaccinated. And that's just where the peak effectiveness occurs.
Have you had any instances where someone who is fully vaccinated has tested positive for COVID, or do you not have those stats?
There have been a few, and we're working on adding more of that detail. But we specifically looked at that with the wrestling tournament outbreak and the cases that came from that. And I have that right here. So between, let's see, from April 1st until May 5th, partway through the day on May 5th, I think it was at 10 a.m., we had had 77 positive cases. Out of all of those, only two people had been fully vaccinated. So two out of 77, 3% of the people who became infected. Of the remaining, 57 of them were completely unvaccinated and over the age of 16. So they were eligible and could have got the vaccine. And then there were another 18 that were under age 16 and not yet eligible to receive the vaccine. And so that's kind of the impact. If you took and had been able to vaccinate those remaining folks, the, what is that, 75 people, and had they been vaccinated, you maybe would have had another two positives out of that. And if that's the case, we would have been at four positives in that time period instead of 77.
Okay. And also should point out that there is a vaccination clinic coming up for those age 12 to 16, correct?
There is, especially sometimes it's good to be the problem child, I guess. And so with our outbreak that's going on, the state of Alaska Public Health reached out to us and said, would you like some help with conducting a vaccine clinic and some extra community testing? And we said, yes, absolutely. So the state is mobilizing a team that will be at K-High this Saturday and Sunday, and they'll be offering testing for anyone symptomatic or asymptomatic that would like it. It will be point of care testing. So your results will be about 30 minutes with high volume. It might extend out to an hour or so just as they process those tests. But about 30 minutes is the time once they put it, once they start the test, for it to process through their machine that they'll be bringing. So they'll be offering testing, anyone symptomatic, asymptomatic. We really encourage people in the schools, parents and kids and teachers to go get that testing. A lot of what we've done is to try to keep kids in school in our community, and we think that's really important. The more we know about what's out there, the better chance that we can do that. So we really encourage people to go get tested, again, regardless of symptoms. We have a high prevalence of COVID in our community, so lots of us are at risk of having contracted it. They will also be offering vaccinations for anyone ages 12 and older at that event. And that's going to be Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. both days. Registration is encouraged, and you can go to covidvax.alaska.gov and get to that clinic from the from that page. You'll find it advertised there. It's called the K-High Pod. And but it's not required. You can just walk in during that time and get your vaccine or get tested, and they will take care of you that way as well.
Okay, great. Well, we're kind of running short on time. There's a lot more we could speak about. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention?
I think those are the big things. I will say I've been very pleased watching social media last night and just listening to what's happening in our community. A lot of businesses are taking this very serious. They're doing their part to help flatten the curve again. We used that term a year or so ago when we first got into this. Our community really pulled together and did a good job with that. And I'm seeing that happening again this time. So I just want to thank the community for their efforts and for their continued support as we try to get through this current outbreak and get the curve flattened back out.
Okay. And I should ask, I mean, obviously you won't know until you see how many more cases develop, but about how long do we have to say not have a certain number of cases before you think we might go back to level three? I mean, I know that's a crystal ball, but
it is. We have some experience with this, and we know that it takes somewhere around a week to 2 weeks to start to really see those numbers trending down and that they're holding and not going to tick back up. So, you know, we will watch this on a daily basis as we have been, and we honestly will try to lower the risk as soon as we're confident that our levels are going to continue down to where we really need them to be. We will lower that risk and inform the community.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining me this morning. A lot of great information. And if people want more information, I believe that's available on the borough's website, and you also have a Facebook page?
It is. Well, we don't have a Facebook page. It's on the borough website. You can go there, just the regular front page of the borough, and at the top, there's a COVID link. You can go to the City of Ketchikan or the Ketchikan Gateway Borough Facebook pages. All of our information posts in both of those locations. I think that was those were the two places that I was going to tell you about. I thought there was one more, but
okay,
that's okay.
All right, great. A lot of great information out there. Again, thank you so much, Abner Hoag, for joining me this morning.